Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to ICYMI.
In case you missed it.
Slate's podcast about internet culture. And Candace, I have an important question for you. We're still in our getting to know each other phase, so I'm just going to be peppering you with questions for the next foreseeable future. And I think the question I'm about to ask you is maybe one of the most important I've asked so far. So you mentioned in your introduction interview that you were a Twilight girly, specifically that you answered Yahoo Answers questions about why the Cullen family in Twilight plays baseball during thunderstorms, which means that I have to ask, are you Team Edward or Team Jacob?
Oh, my God.
I think we should do like we did for the Robert De Niro versus Al Pacino debate, where we just answer on three. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
So we don't have an opportunity to change our answers. Okay. Mm-hmm. One, two, three. Jacob.
Team Edward.
I'm sorry. What?
So look, here's the deal. I am Team Edward. For two reasons. The first one just being that it's pretty obvious that Stephenie Meyer's whole thing is that this is the Edward Cullen hero's journey. He was always, you know, the main character. He was always going to win. The second thing is I remember Breaking Dawn Part 1. I remember sitting in the Edwards Theater and thinking, oh my God, Bella is getting dicked down by this sparkly snail, and I am a little curious. And I'm just saying, why would you deny the opportunity to break some Wayfair furniture?
Yeah. One, I hope it's better than Wayfair furniture because Edward Cullen is rich. That's A. B, I don't want to die. He's not worth dying over. The thing about Edward is he's very emo and not in a fun way. Second, canonically, Jacob Black is a man of color, and I will always stand by my people. Okay?
Okay.
Taylor Lautner is a white man. That's unexcusable. However, Jacob was a man of color. He was fun. He built motorcycles. You could take him out to dinner without worrying about him having to throw up a ravioli later. There were a lot of reasons that Jacob was the better choice. Mostly that he just seemed like a better time. And I rest my case there. Obviously, we could talk about this forever because I think you're wrong. I think you're very wrong.
Wow. We're going on Judge Judy. I hope you know that. Continue.
Well, we'll wait for Judge Judy to adjudicate, but we have a show to do, which is about a topic I often think about in conjunction with Twilight because they took over my life around the same time. And that thing is Tumblr. Y'all out there listening, we're probably like, wow. Rachel's a co-host. She's probably going to stop talking about Tumblr. Joke's on you. Tumblr is forever. Mm-hmm. But today's episode is actually brought to you not by me, but by another Slate staffer, Luke Winky. Because back in March, Luke wrote this really great piece for the newsletter Dirt called Urban Outfitters Literature. Remember when Tumblrs turned into picture books? And I didn't remember until I read this piece. And then I remembered everything everywhere all at once.
Exactly. Because I think this piece really took both of us back into the mall, okay? The carpet that was so dirty you couldn't see your feet. And if you haven't walked in a mall in like the last 5 years, Luke's piece was talking about those small coffee table type picture books. You usually find them in like a gag gift corner at like Urban Outfitters or Kitson or like Barnes & Noble. And they were usually called something like Hipster Puppies, which is the title of an actual book that hit the shelves. And it was written by Christopher R. Weingarten.
Or the Tumblr Garfield minus Garfield, where Dan Walsh took out the titular character Garfield from the comic strip and turned that into a whole book.
Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, kind of reminds me of like the Big Bang Theory and how people would edit out the laugh track. And it would just sound so dead. And you like ask yourself, is this show actually funny? Or does Sheldon just like want me to think this is funny?
It's definitely the latter. Luke also interviewed Rachel Fershleiser, who was the head of Tumblr's literary division.
Wait, they had a literary division?
Yes, because Tumblr is literature. And she knew that. And she's now the vice president of Soft Skull Press. She talked to Luke about why publishers were so thirsty for these Tumblr blogs. And it might have had something to do with that specific Obama era, 2010, 2012 millennial humor. You know, like Lena Dunham, Lin-Manuel Miranda,
Rose Alte. I mean, look, I'm already interested in Luke's piece because anytime we can dunk on LMM, I'm in.
I mean, same, though I'm going to just out myself and say I still definitely bump the Hamilton soundtrack from time to time. I will hold myself accountable, but I digress. Back to these Tumblr picture books. What was in the air during those feverish days of the early Obama administration where people thought that race was over and that the publication of books like Hipster Puppies or Garfield Minus Garfield or This Is Why You're Fat was something worthwhile? Yeah. We'll never know. That's a lie. We will know. We'll find out after a short break.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy as is genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And we're back with Luke Winky, a staff writer at Slate. Hello, Luke. How are you?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. I'm a huge fan of your work. I feel like you really have this great intersection of deranged things on the internet and the things that I'm interested in. And I love that for both of us.
It's true. What I just started here last week and my editor told me one of my beats was just weird things happening on Reddit. And that's what I'm all about.
Wow. I'm so excited to figure out what weird things you dig up on Reddit. But before that, we have to ask you the question we ask everyone, which is what is your very first internet memory? I hope it is as deranged as some of the things that you write about.
Man, it was like the mid 90s. My parents like work in like a technology adjacent field and they just kind of set me up on the family computer with a browser. Just like, oh, you should check out the internet. Like it took me some like game site or something. I can't remember. I didn't really understand what it was for. I remember playing some, you know, pretty primitive, probably like pre-flash games on one of the web pages you ended up on. And I was thinking about that in the sense, I just don't know if parents quite do that now with the internet in circa 2023. That's just being like, hey, you should check out the internet. You should go see what's out there. I feel like back then it was very new and very optimistic. And I think parents probably have not the same relationship with the internet now than they did back in those days.
Exactly. And I mean, like, Luke, honest question, were you a dial-up family? Is that the era we're in?
Man, I think at that part of my childhood, we were kind of post-dial-up. We were dial-up at one point. Like, I remember hearing the tone and my parents getting online in that way. But I feel like by the time I was officially like surfing on the web, we were a broadband family. But, you know, I'd have to check the tape on that one. I don't know for sure.
I also have to imagine that when you first approached the internet, you did not interact with something called Tumblr.com.
No, yet. I was born in 1991. So Tumblr was just a twinkle in someone's eye back in those days.
Exactly. And so today we are having a conversation about an article you wrote, but the article involves Tumblr. So I just wanted to ask you, what's your Tumblr experience? When do you remember getting on it? What do you look at? Do you still use it?
Yeah, some people are like deep Tumblr people that, like, you know, are capable of like really waxing poetic about, you know, their life growing up on Tumblr and getting kind of teary-eyed about it. I was not like a Tumblr person to that degree. I would go to individual Tumblrs and look at the photos, but I was never part of the community in the way that some people speak about it. A lot of my interactions with Tumblr back in those days were almost like derisive, where I was on an internet forum that was maybe a little bit more edgy and people like linking out to, some sweaty One Direction erotica on Tumblr or the just girly things Tumblr, things of that nature. So I was probably like a more of a Tumblr enemy the way I came up on the internet, I feel. Not anymore, obviously. I'm very pro-Tumblr.
I feel like you were just dragging me by accident.
us together.
I really feel like I entered a different plane when you said One Direction erotica and just girly things.tumblr.com. And it's honestly a pure plane. Let's go back. Let's go back to that.
No, this is like not to get ahead of ourselves. Like when I wrote the article we're going to talk about, the one thing that kind of pops up is just kind of how innocent and pure and less ironic the internet was. Very Obama era, very first term Obama era back in those early Tumblr days.
You are perfectly leading us into our interview, which is about the article you wrote and the Obama era that it came out of. So tell us a little bit about this article and how it came to you. Where were you sitting when you thought, where'd those Tumblr picture books go?
I think I was thinking a lot about Urban Outfitters and the kind of clothes I would buy from Urban Outfitters, which, you know, were just had no mercy on my round table pizza paychecks. You know, I just was not really able to splurge too much. And that was something that was so kind of, you know, that was part and parcel with Urban were these picture books, basically adult picture books that were kind of, you know, kind of cheeky, kind of, you know, kind of meme-y that were based off these tumblers. And they would just kind of be out there kind of in like the, you know, your checkout aisle, your Garfields minus Garfield or whatever. And, I was just thinking, man, that really was a flash in the pan, right? There was like this like 2 year period where you could actually get like a publishing deal off of a Tumblr. And then that market just sort of disappeared immediately. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to some of the folks that managed to turn their Tumblr into a book deal to see if they made any money off of it, how they remember that era. I thought maybe there could be like a con man like element of like, I can't believe I wrote those that publisher to give me a deal off the stupid blog I came up with. And So started sending some emails and wanted to talk to the people that struck it big on Tumblr during the very, very small amount of time that was possible.
The only people who ever made money on that platform, truly.
I love that setup because you use the phrase adult picture books. Your article is basically about Tumblr posts becoming picture books. And that phrase picture books kind of struck me a little bit because I was like, you know, I unfortunately only think of children reading those. And in a similar comparison, I think we are just as a society getting over the fact that animated films, for example, aren't just for kids. You know, there's so many great award-winning animated films made for and by adults. So like Isle of Dogs or Intergalactic from Kid Cudi or Wendell and Wild. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the distinction between the picture books that Urban shelling that are being created from the throes of Tumblr and how they're kind of different from like comic books or graphic novels or basically any illustrated piece of art for an adult audience.
Yeah, I think the one distinguishing factor is they were kind of trying to be these coffee table books for people that were like way outside of the age demographic to have coffee tables or coffee table books, you know, like they were marketed towards probably people in their early 20s, you know, people that were like, you know, maybe at least tertiarily aware of what Tumblr was and wanted to, you know, have like a physical copy of it. And I think for me, as someone that spent a lot of time online, that was one of the first moments seeing those books and kind of around, you know, stores like Urban, you know, my friend's apartments or whatever, where I was like, wow, the internet kind of is just culture now. You know, this stuff that existed like entirely in cyberspace that just felt like so divorced from like mainstream culture to kind of see like nice glossy book with all these internet-y jokes. You know, these days, I don't think any of us would think anything of that. That's just how life works. But at the time, it almost felt like the tide was starting to turn. Millennials were taking a more paramount kind of place in culture that, you know, our dumb internet jokes were worthy of being sold for $25.99 while waiting to check out with your skinny cords at Urban Outfitters.
You know, I recently was like in a Barnes and Noble, and in the corner of this Barnes and Noble, there were just a bunch of these picture books that I think fall into this category you were writing about, Luke, and they were under the category sale, but they were also under the category gag gifts. And I think you touched upon this in your article about how these books weren't necessarily considered literature, but they were considered gag gifts. They were used as this idea of like, I wouldn't buy this for myself, but like, I think that'd look really good on my friend's Wayfair coffee table. When the publishing industry started buying these tumblers, turning them into books, do you feel like artists were able to retain the creativity and artistry, or do you sense that there was some type of like selling out or like watering down that kind of happened once it entered the machine?
I don't know if I would say selling out is exactly what the term I would reach for. What I will say is that one person I spoke to like really approached his Tumblr in a really mercenary way. He had a Tumblr called Hipster Puppies, which is a bunch of photos of dogs with, you know, horn rim glasses or flannel shirts on them, with, you know, some pithy caption about, you know, the music they listen to or whatever. And that was a completely intentional ploy to try to get a book of, you know, I'm seeing all these picture books out here. I'm seeing all these Tumblr books that are blowing up. I know if I put some photos of some puppies with glasses, I'm going to, like, a publisher is going to reach out to me if I get enough people to subscribe to it. And, you know, I'll be in every Urban Outfitters in America. And that was a very like intentional battle plan. There's not a lot of soulfulness in the genesis of Hipster Puppies. Maybe the original wave of people that, you know, just enjoyed photoshopping Garfield out of Garfield comic strips. And, you know, all of a sudden they were reached by a publisher. It's like, oh, this is crazy. This little silly passion project I did. Now I'm turning into a book. But like, I got the sense that pretty clearly people saw that this was a model to exploit and to make some money off of within the realm of Tumblr. So in that case, you can't really soul out, or you can't really like lose your spirit in the kind of corporate publishing grind, right? Because that's exactly what you wanted to enter, is the corporate publishing grind. And also the most important thing, these books are pretty easy to put together. You know, you are basically copying and pasting what's in your Tumblr. Pretty content light, I would say.
What's funny about these Tumblr picture books, which is that no one on Tumblr, I think, would actually buy these books. They kind of always had this veneer of hipsterism, but not in the hipsterism that Tumblr really loved.
Yeah, or like I spoke to in the story, I spoke to the person that was head of Tumblr publishing at this time. And you know, I kind of put it to her, I was like, what were these books for? And she said, you know, back in those days, not everyone was on the internet in the way that people are now. Like, it's easier to imagine someone in 2009 of not being able to find and parse a blog like This Is Why You're Fat. That was a blog of just really horrific American food items that I think netted a huge book deal once they turned it into a book. There was more of a use case back in those days of just people that weren't really able to understand or get on Tumblr or kind of understand that culture to actually, you know, find a book and page through it to, and, you know, have it make them laugh. Like, you know, there was, you know, this is also kind of like we're the borderline of like the kind of iPhone and iPad revolution. You know, this is a pretty desktop laptop, you know, based culture. So I do think that this stuff was a bit like on the shoulder between the total internet singularity that we live in now.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that totally makes sense. And I actually think this is a good spot to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk to Luke about the millennial humor that caused these books to skyrocket.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham. And this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Hi, ICYMI listeners. If you love our podcast, then consider subscribing to Slate Plus. There are no ads on any Slate podcasts, and this is the best way to support the podcast because this show would not be possible without your support. Slate Plus helps keep the show going. And with Slate Plus, you can get bonus segments or episodes for shows like Slow Burn, Hit Parade, or Dear Prudence. There's unlimited reading on the Slate website, which means you get access to every article and advice column on Slate. You'll never hit the paywall. Visit slate.com/ICYMI+ to sign up. That's slate.com/ICYMI+. And we're back. So when Rachel and I read your piece, Luke, we both kind of loved how you poked fun at this very appropriate phrase to describe the humor of these books.
You use this phrase, Obama-era millennial taste, to describe the types of tumblers that became picture books. You asked this question that I thought was really smart, which was, what was going on in the late 2000s milieu that made our memes so much brighter and optimistic and more vulnerable compared to the irony poison nihilism that circulates through our timelines in the 2020s? And one of your sources suggests that change was caused by the rise of algorithmic feeds. And I'm wondering if you agree with that.
I've been trying to crack this question for years now to figure out like why the internet felt different back in those days. I do think that's as good of an answer as I've heard, that like there's something about just not having the content immediately sorted and served up to you as soon as you log on somewhere, having to kind of seek it out a little bit more and kind of curate it yourself. I don't know. I think that there was something kind of more personable, more wholesome about that. And there was a good piece in Defector recently just about how big the internet used to feel, you know, where we weren't always kind of funneled into basically the 4 websites that matter that we go to every day that none of us seem to like. You know, you can kind of really do some internet exploring in a more real way back in those days. It still felt fairly new back in the rise of Tumblr, and it was more delightful. There was just more optimism about it. You know, it was more exciting to see what you turned up. Even like the gross parts of the internet weren't as gross as they are now. But I do think the algorithmic curation that does kind of affect that.
We also brought up the algorithm because I was thinking a lot about Urban Outfitters, and just maybe the reason Urban was such a perfect place for these picture books is because it made every discovery seem really organic, right? Like your friend would be shopping for shirts, graphic tees. Your other friend is by the vinyls. That's a whole other conversation. And here you are looking at a cactus with a face and being like, whoa, look at this picture book where Garfield isn't in Garfield. Isn't that so funny? And I just think there's something about the way that retail stores create an algorithm that kind of tricks you into thinking you're the first person who's ever seen this, created this, bought this, whatever. And as we speak to that, I did kind of want to flip over and talk a little bit about the numbers and like the financials of this entire lineage. In your reporting, did you find out anything about like how much these people made from like selling their books to publishers and stuff like that?
Yeah, the people I talked to, no one made like truly life-changing money. You know, it was, you know, they did okay. It was a nice, especially if you're a freelancer, you know, you're happy for that payout. I mean, the dirty secret of publishing is no one makes any money off of books for the most part. I mean, that is the truth. But, you know, considering the effort that it takes to put together a Tumblr book where you are, you know, sourcing some funny photos and clearing them and basically kind of cannibalizing your own content in a hardcover book, you know, you got to feel pretty good about, you know, making like, I have to go look at the exact numbers, but it was like, you know, 10,000, 15,000, somewhere in that ballpark, really. Nothing life-changing, but you know, again, it's better than $0, which is what most tumblers made.
Mm-hmm. Which I think the point I'm also trying to get to is like, you're right, it's not life-changing money. It might be like year TurboTax changing money, mm-hmm. but the other thing is this type of pipeline is maybe not for full-time authors. It's for comedians who like have a funny Tumblr and like maybe can get a new revenue stream, which is kind of the same philosophy of like celebrities doing podcasts. It's like, no, Rachel Bilson is an actress. She just also wants to do this podcast for fun. But yeah, that kind of makes sense that like this might not be the most lucrative way to go, but like it is something, and something might be better than nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we're talking mostly about this in the context of Tumblr, but like kind of in that same era, there were a lot of like Twitter comedians that just got books of their tweets published, like the famous Shit My Dad Says guy, who was like the first Twitter celebrity. He got a TV show out of that. He got a book deal out of that. He's still working. He's still writing for TV, I think. You know, still has a real career, all off of a Twitter account. I think there was in general, like, and maybe this is weird to say and you guys might disagree with it, but like, I feel like there is like, in a weird way, like more kind of upside to becoming famous online in that, in those early days, just in terms of it just being so new of like, you know, you can kind of get like, you know, you can get a book deal off of having 50,000 followers on Twitter back in those days, which obviously you could do that now. But I don't know. I just feel like it's a little more ordinary to have any kind of following online. Like back in those days, I feel like people were really coming out you to really reward you for that. I don't know how true that is, but I feel like it's true.
I feel like that's true as well. There's just a lot more internet fame to go around. So back in the day, to be internet famous felt like something extraordinary versus now your average college student at NYU can have 1 million followers on TikTok and that doesn't really net them much. There also seemed, we're talking about really kind of traditional modes of media like book publishing, television shows. That route from internet fame to those traditional modes is like a lot different now. Now you can be internet famous for much longer and get the kind of upside of that, which is like a BarkBox deal sponsorship. Yeah. But actually landing like a Harper's Collins deal is, I think, a lot rarer for the average influencer. Yeah.
It's something I touched on in the piece that like, maybe there is a chance to make more money in a more sustainable way long term when you're famous on the internet now. But the way you have to do that is just seems more depressing, where it's Instagram sponsored content or, you know, your BarkBox subscription, your first bet FanDuel discount code or whatever. You know, there is something maybe a little bit more wholesome and godly about like, oh, I got famous online and now I have a book of my posts that you can buy if you so want. There's something better about that than putting out like same game parlays on the Jets game or whatever. I don't know. I do believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're kind of talking about publishing and I couldn't help but notice that most of the people you mentioned in your article were white men. And I was wondering if that's a reflection of who was getting these deals in that era, because that also kind of falls into like what influencer sponsorships look like now.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Like, because when you think of like Tumblr at the time, there's so many people of color and, you know, it was so LGBTQ. Like, I don't know, like that is kind of the legacy of the platform. And it is, maybe I wasn't looking hard enough. Maybe I could have done a better job reporting the story. But like, it is kind of interesting that like the people that bubbled to the top were, you know, kind of white dudes that all like work in marketing or technology now. Like that seems to be the general clientele. That is a shame.
You know, I don't think it's necessarily crazy or wild that a lot of the people who were making money off Tumblr turned picture books were white men. My theory on it is just that I think that Urban Outfitters is low-key kind of a flattening of pop culture. I think they just always knew how to get the most eyes, which is to be the most relatable, flattened version possible, the most mainstream possible. And another site that reminds me of this is unfortunately BuzzFeed, which was very big at the time, too. Mm-hmm. Now, BuzzFeed has evolved. I mean, Quinta Brunson got in there, Justin Tan got in there, and they were able to kind of create something more specific, more for people like me and Rachel. But I do think something that I'm kind of also turning back to is the fact that, like, could this Tumblr picture book thing happen in 2023? Like, Luke, do you think there's a compatible parallel?
The internet just doesn't really work that way anymore. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like the idea of the entire publishing industry, like circling around like one thing that's happening online. I just don't know if that's really the ecosystem or economy that we kind of live in anymore.
I feel like one of the underlying themes we're talking about in that period is there was this real shock that you can make money off of social media, where I feel like now anyone who opens an account in 2023 is aware of the possibility of monetization. And I'm wondering if you feel like that kind of specter of profit impacts the kind of content that gets published online.
So much of the Tumblrs we're talking about, even the early Twitter feed, so much of like the content that existed, the user-generated content that existed on the internet in those days, seemed to really just come from a place of like, hey, look, I can make this thing. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to post a photo, the same photo of the cast from Full House every day. Isn't that funny? You know, I think it was Dave Coulier, I believe. That is the Tumblr. And like I said earlier, like almost within a couple of years, a guy was trying to crack the code and, you know, to get his hipster puppies project off the ground. Yeah, I like, you know, I don't know. We go online all the time and see hilarious jokes or, you know, really salient takes or kind of mind blowing stuff that doesn't feel particularly profit motivated. But I guess like it is sometimes kind of a bummer when you see someone blowing up online for something that they made. That's really cool. And you can kind of already see their wheels turning of how to kind of capitalize on it or what their next step's going to be or how they're going to, you know, what they should outfit their link tree with or, you know, what merch they're going to print. All that kind of stuff. Like people really look at it as like a way out from wherever they are currently. Like, okay, finally. And, you know, I think everyone's kind of guilty. If you've like, even people in the media are kind of guilty of feeling that like that sometimes, you know, like, okay, cool. I wrote this thing did well, so how am I going to capitalize on this? How can I kind of exploit it? So I don't think it's specific to like people that were on Tumblr necessarily, but I guess that's the thing that I think wasn't always the case. Like the real feeling that like that whatever cool thing you make has to be a stepping stone into, you know, cashing in or kind of building your brand. You know, you can't really blame them, you know, like, I mean, I don't think you can blame anyone for feeling that way. But I do think that has sort of changed the way the shape of the internet, certainly.
All right, that is the show. We'll be back in your feed on Saturday, so please subscribe. It is the best way to never miss an episode, to never miss me telling Candace that she's wrong for being Team
Wow.
Edward. Please leave a rating and review on Apple or Spotify. Tell your friends about us. Tell your werewolves about us. Not the vampires, though. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymy_pod, which is also where you can DM us your questions like, remember when those books were tumblers? And you could also always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spradley Ricks, Rachel Hampton, and me, Candace Lim. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. See you online.
Or at Urban Outfitters.